It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How does a handmade artisan bow tie make both a fashion and an environmental statement? Nisha Blackwell is the founder and creative force behind Knotsland, a neckwear company born in Homewood. We spoke in December of 2018, just after this program expanded to daily and as Knotsland was getting some national attention. I asked her to think back before Knotsland took off and whether she ever imagined becoming a successful entrepreneur.
I mean, I never, ever could have imagined having a bow tie company. I grew up around entrepreneurs, but I never thought that I would be an entrepreneur. So, yeah.
So I understand that you were in nursing school at the time, working at a coffee shop to help pay the bills. You got laid off. And a friend's daughter's birthday party was coming up. Really limited funds, if any, to really provide that nice gift. So what happened?
I kind of looked around at my resources. I was in a panic because I wanted to do something really, really special. And I didn't have the financial resources to do so. And I'm like, what do I have that I can like really take to the next level? And I had a sewing machine that was still in a box in the corner, and I had a bag of thrifted fabric, and I made it work.
Had you been sewing all along?
No, never sewed.
You had a sewing machine in a box and you hadn't used it. You didn't know how to use it.
Did not know how to use it. I was actually intimidated. I was afraid I was going to break it. So it sat in the corner in the box for about 5 months before I even would touch it.
Okay. So, well, you obviously made something from it, self-taught.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I pulled up YouTube and I was like, how do I use this? I typed in the model of the sewing machine and a bunch of videos came up and I'm like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I rewind as many times as I needed to. And I mean, literally zoomed in on certain aspects, like everything from like figuring out how to turn the thing on to what plugs go where, every single thing I've learned from typing it in.
I guess you had it up here what you wanted to make for this daughter of your friend. I mean, well, something came up. You made hair bows.
Yeah.
But it was like, now, how do I get from this point to that point?
Yeah, it was like, it literally felt like forever, but it was all night that I was up teaching myself how to sew, first of all. And then I finally was able to make some stitches. I'm like, okay, I need to just go for what I have. I had some ribbon, I had some hair ties, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to make all of these things work.
And obviously, they were a hit at the party.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was super duper shy when I first went. I mean, she's been my friend since preschool, so she kind of knows that I've always been a little creative. So I gave her the box and I was like, hey, you know, I was afraid they were going to fall apart, like when the baby opened the box. And so I was like, hey, you know, I'm creative and I just wanted to like show how much I love Runasia and just like really make something special. And she's like, oh, I'm not worried about it. Thank you. I'm just happy you're here. I'm happy you came. So then during the time when the baby went to, you know, when everyone crowds around the baby in the high chair and she's opening the gifts, and literally like everyone was like, oh my gosh, where did she get those from? And I was kind of in the background because I, again, was nervous that they would be like scraps on the chair. And yeah, it was the reverse. I left that party with at least 5 customers.
When did it hit you that, all right, I can make this for friends or friends of friends, but it's not a business? When did it hit you and say, I can make a living out of this, or let me try to start making a living out of this?
Well, it wasn't until later, after I made the bow ties. Like, so, you know, later in the summer, they started requesting things for little boys. And so a friend of mine was like, it'd be cool if you made bow ties. So I went into like this heavily like space where I was like researching and developing like what it would look like to make a bow tie. I've never had an attachment to a bow tie. So I was like, okay, I have to figure this out.
And any men in your family wear bow ties?
No. No one. So with that, a friend of mine was like, you know, now that you're making these bow ties, you should go apply to one of the startup accelerators in the city. And I was like, oh, come on. Like, I'm just doing this to, you know, I'm in nursing school. I'm trying to, like, just make some extra money. And she was like, no, I think you're onto something. You know, you have this, you're using reused materials and, you know, you're just doing these things that I think would be cool for you to at least try to apply. So that's when I applied. And once I got into the accelerator, I was like, okay, I could take this seriously. I have to take it seriously because now I can't just like go in here, you know, I'm like not knowing what I'm walking into, but also like whatever happens, happens.
It's no longer a hobby to make a few bucks.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, okay, now I have to take this seriously. And when I got in a room of 100 entrepreneurs and looked around, I'm like, oh yeah, I have to like step it up.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Nisha Blackwell. She's the founder, the creative force behind Knotsland, a Homewood-based, homegrown company, makes fashionable neckwear, and saves materials that would be headed for the landfill otherwise. So why is it important to sort of prevent that materials? Because we don't realize some of the components that go into the materials and what they can do to our environment.
Oh, yeah. Depending on who you ask, fashion, the fashion industry as a whole is either the first or second most polluting industry in the world. And it would only come second to oil. And that's because of all of the different components in which fashion operates. You have the water that it takes to make a T-shirt or a pair of jeans, all the way to the water that's being ruined from the runoffs. And I mean, transportation, you have even the care for garments once you get them in your possession, from the energy used to wash them and clean them. And, you know, it's just like there's so many different. And when you think about the ethical, you know, component, it's just there's a lot of things that are happening with the fashion industry that's, yeah.
And some of the materials actually themselves, the polyesters, the synthetics as well.
Totally, totally. And so once you do all of those processes and you no longer want it, a lot of individuals will just like get rid of it, toss it out as if it's like going to just like go away. But it's like really educating people on how to take responsibility before it goes away, because it doesn't really go away. It goes into landfills and it takes forever to biodegrade, because a lot of times it's like cotton blends, like blended with polyester and nylon, things that don't, like they take forever to biodegrade, even if they do.
How did that become sort of part of your mission?
So it goes back to my roots. We always thrifted growing up, and I didn't really see it as like a trendy, cool thing. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I grew up, I still kept this like idea of like, I love to like get these rare items and pieces of clothing that no one else had. So I had gotten into this like real, this cool like online Instagram community where I would like buy things from California, I would buy things from Chicago, I would buy, and not always because they were vintage sizes would they fit really well. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do something with these. So I would put them in a bag. Like I do generally give things to the VA, but right, there are always certain things that I just love the print. I love the pattern. And I'm going to keep these. So that was the first source of fabric that I used for the hair bows. And so I knew that I'm like, you know, this is something like there's so much fabric here that could be used instead of me like tossing it out or getting rid of it. I just would look around the house at like different things, like especially project based things, like, oh, yeah, I wanted to redo my pillows and I never used that fabric. Oh, I can actually use it for these bow ties and for the hair bows, you know. So it started as just like I'm using the resources that I have. And I'm like, wow, this is, you know, actually doing something good. And I didn't even realize it, you know.
Right. So how do you go about sort of the rescuing of materials that would be headed for a landfill and turning those into the beautiful bow ties? Who do you work with?
Our primary source is Pittsburgh Center for Creative Reuse. Mm-hmm. I love that place so much. I mean, when I first started my business, I remember like I was like an ant. I would beeline because it's super close to my home. And I would beeline there and just go and check out the fabric section. It was just like this like hidden treasure. So Creative Reuse is still one of those main sources. But we've also collaborated with the Pittsburgh Opera, who has given us some of their things from their costumes. And, you know, they just had nothing else to do with them, which was great because we were like, yes, we'll take it.
I want to talk about Homewood. Born, raised, you have this company. Why did you want to make sure it stayed in Homewood to help revitalize your old neighborhood? What?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up during a time where I watched like Homewood kind of decline a bit. And it was just seemed as though it was just like a neglected neighborhood. And I knew that there was a reason I boomeranged back to my grandfather's house in that same community, walked the streets. And I was like, I just want to be a part of positive change. And when I came, I just like figured out how to get involved with, I got involved with the Re-Energize Pittsburgh program through GTEC, now Grounded. And that was when I started saying, okay, I need to like really build something more than, you know, just kind of going to meetings. I wanted to like build something that was like helpful to the revitalization in the long run.
All right. Your employees, about how many are most of them women? Do they have experience as seamstresses? What?
Yeah. So our, oh my goodness, our seamstress community is the power behind Knotsland.
I mean, the word community.
Yeah. Yeah. And we build a community of women who we recruit and train to sew the bow ties. They take their materials home and they sew from home. But like I say that in such a space in which it's so much more than that. Like women are really invested in the growth. Like we have people who come from a little outside, like more like past Monroeville, who will come pick up pieces, and they're always all over the place, like trying to figure out ways to grow Knotsland, and they're just passionate beyond that. So it's so great to build this community of women who are just carrying us. It's amazing.
As we've learned, self-taught in terms of making the bow tie, self-taught in terms of developing a business. Are you helping them along, encouraging them to sort of get into the business world, not just I'm making a product for my boss?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I encourage that. I mean, that's why we have flexible income opportunities, because when I started Knotsland, I worked at different places to make sure that I had money to infuse into my business. And so I wanted to create an opportunity for other people who may want to start a business or grow a business to be able to make extra money and not have to be like, you know, like strapped to a place or a time for a certain period of time. You know, it's kind of like the Ubering idea, the skill sharing, if you, right. Yeah.
You've created a line of bow ties for the highly respected men's store, Larimore's, mm-hmm. and I believe also Macy's in Atlanta, Philadelphia Fashion Week. So this Homewood-based business, fledgling business that started with hair bows, getting national attention, what's your reaction?
I feel like it's walking in my purpose. It's a combination. I mean, when people receive a bow tie in a little package, they receive that bow tie, but there's so many more things intertwined, from the environmental aspect all the way to the social component. So it's really allowed me to combine all of the things that I really love and that I'm passionate about and put them into this product, you know? So I think people feel that, people see that, and people support that. And it's a company that people get behind because of all of the values.
Since Nisha and I spoke in December 2018, Knotsland has moved into a new space in the Regent Square, Wilkinsburg area, and her bow ties are on display at the Frick Museum's Maker and Muse exhibition and at Concept Art Gallery. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, suffragette and civil rights activist Daisy Lampkin dies in 1965. The Reading, Pennsylvania native moved to Pittsburgh, where she married and developed her passion for social justice. She began holding local suffragist meetings at her home, and after moving within the city limits, became involved in equality groups for African American women. She assembled gatherings and met with national leaders in the movement, ultimately serving as the chairwoman of the Allegheny County Negro Women's Republican League. She's also credited with recruiting future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall to become part of the NAACP in the late 1930s. She died in Pittsburgh in 1965 and is buried in Homewood Cemetery. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Nico Case. Born in Alexandria, Virginia, Nico Case's family moved around during her childhood until eventually settling in Tacoma, Washington. She left home at 15 and went to college in Vancouver, where she began performing as a drummer and singer in the vibrant local punk scene. She sang with the New Pornographers, a Canadian band that earned unexpected success in the indie rock world. Case's solo career took off too, as she honed the eccentric lyrics and stark musical arrangements that she called country noir.
This tornado loves you, this tornado loves you, this tornado loves you.
She formed Case Lang Veers with Katie Lang and Laura Veers in 2016 and has continued to work with the New Pornographers and on her solo albums. A playlist with music from all of WYEP's Women's History Month artists is at WYEP.org/women.
Protecting public health during the coronavirus outbreak is a top priority, but the economic contagion is a serious threat as well. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA. With cases of COVID-19 continuing to spread in Pennsylvania, local employers are limiting travel, updating their cleaning policies, and in some cases canceling conferences, all in an effort to keep their workers safe. Eric Fair is with Schneider Downs, a Pittsburgh firm that provides risk management services to regional clients. He tells me which local sectors are most at risk.
I think it'd be the manufacturing, the retail, where you have the workers front and center and you need them to be at these locations to either produce the supplies or, you know, be in the store to sell to the customers, right? I think, you know, oftentimes we look at technology and leverage technology and, you know, remote work, work from home policies, but, you know, not all organizations have the ability to accommodate that.
So if this virus isn't abating at all, and if a manufacturer has to take some action, but the employees still have to work, are there still things they can do to help protect these employees?
Certainly. I think an increase in cleaning supplies in the areas. I think the continuous communication, knowing the individuals that are on their manufacturing line that are at risk, you know, understanding the underlying issues and determining those individuals up front and making sure that they're in a safe haven to where they can be protected as much as they can.
So what is the best way that business owners can make employees feel at ease amid the uncertainty? Some people are more anxious than others and more fearful. And even if they're taking these precautions that you've laid out, what other things can they do to communicate to employees that they really have a steady hand, you know, running the show?
Just the constant communication, the buy-in from upper management, the reevaluation of human resource policies, work from home, and I've seen organizations even create email accounts to, you know, have inquiries submitted just for Q&A, and things to that nature.
Can employees do anything to help their customers during this period?
Certainly, that's a great question. I think, you know, we're running into that being a client-serving profession, right, in the accounting industry. But, you know, it's speaking to our clients up front, you know, in the event we have to go on site to meet with them, it's having that conversation. Are they comfortable? What are their procedures in helping mitigate the risk of spreading this? And I think at the same time, it's, you know, us as risk advisory professionals, you know, within our practice at Schneider Downs, looking at what customers might need these types of plans and these types of conversations just to help them get the ball rolling. You know, I think a lot of times individuals and organizations don't know where to start.
Do you think the Pittsburgh region has weathered this storm pretty well thus far?
Thus far, but it seems like, you know, it just keeps creeping in and it seems as if it's coming from the perimeter and moving inward. Keep your eyes open and monitor the CDC and the Allegheny Health Department and things like that to really keep you abreast of what's going on.
Sounds like communication is really key here.
Absolutely. From the public to the employers to the employees and back the other way. It's monumental in making this a effective way to combat, mitigate the coronavirus.
Eric Fair is a manager with Schneider Downs in their IT risk advisory practice. In WESA Business Headlines, the new owners of the Southside Works in Pittsburgh unveiled a plan this week to invest over $37 million in capital improvements and more than $130 million in new development. The plan by Samara Road includes converting the Southside Works Cinema into office space for new tech and creative tenants. And Coriopolis-based Dick's Sporting Goods topped Wall Street expectations. The sporting goods retailer posted profits of $68.9 million in the fourth quarter. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Who belongs? It's a question that dominates a lot of political conversation. Who can come into the country? Who can afford which school districts? Who belongs in which neighborhoods? As part of Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 series, reporter Max Marin has this profile of a family in Philadelphia fighting to put down roots in a working-class neighborhood known for being exclusionary.
Yali Perez was a new mom when she witnessed a fatal shooting outside her home in North Philadelphia. That night, she decided she had to move.
I can't see anybody else get shot. I don't want my kid, to get shot. So we were like, we're just going to pick the safest area.
It needed to be safe, but also affordable. That's how she found Bridesburg, a working-class neighborhood a few miles away that rarely makes the news for violence.
The school had good ratings at the time.
She bought a house here with her mother in 2013 and immediately felt some relief.
When Pokemon Go was like a big deal, like I had no problems walking around here at night, like looking for Pokemon with my kid.
But there's just one thing. Yali's family is Puerto Rican and Bridesburg is overwhelmingly white, with a reputation for being hostile to outsiders, especially people of color. It didn't take long for Yali to see how racial animosity here escalates things from good to bad to worse.
Black family who just moved in got into a fight with a white family up the block because their son called their son a n***.
Pandemonium erupted that night. The feuding families called on relatives for backup. The police came. Shortly after, Yali said the black family moved out. As one of the few Puerto Rican families in the neighborhood, Yali worries about her son, Ian, who's now 10 years old, getting in a similar situation.
This is why you don't go outside, because kids start a fight and then grown-ups think it's their job to fix it. And this is the way that it goes down. And that's how it's always been.
Yali works from home as a freelancer, writing about Japanese anime and its intersection with motherhood. Ian has inherited his mother's love of geek culture. Both are rocking dyed hair at the moment. Yali's is a purple and blue. Ian's is a bright orange.
I did all that stuff when I was younger, too.
And she used that long hair.
Yeah. I had bright red hair like that one time.
In this former industrial neighborhood with an old school mentality, it's easy to see how they could stand out. And it was only 25 years ago that Bridesburg made national headlines for how it treated someone who looked different.
Police continue to investigate last weekend's hate crime in the Bridesburg section of Philadelphia.
Within hours of moving into Bridesburg in 1996, a black woman named Bridget Ward and her family immediately became the target of racist death threats.
She found racial epithets on the front and back porch and some ketchup supposed to look like blood on the steps to the house.
The incident and its aftermath were broadcasted nationally by Ted Koppel on ABC's Nightline. Ward moved out less than a month after arriving.
I don't need to live with these kind of people. I'm better than them.
In Nightline's coverage, many defended their treatment of Ward on the basis of her skin color and the fact that she was a low-income renter. Other neighbors criticized the blatant racism.
My mother raised nine of us. She said, no matter what color or what nationality, if they're good, they're good. Everybody deserves a chance.
Today, Yali says it's still common to hear racial slurs in bars and other places in the area.
The N-word gets used a lot by people who are not black around here. Is a common word, which is funny because I haven't heard that in like 20 years.
A white supremacist group openly flyered the neighborhood in 2018, and Yali's family has faced many questions loaded with stereotypes.
Like, I promise you, I don't even know a gang member. No, not other Latinos are coming, guys. It's just our family. Oh, aren't you from like Second Street? Oh, that's where all the Puerto Ricans are. It's like, oh, we don't do parties. You know, Suavemente is not going to be on 24 hours, I promise you.
But sometimes the question isn't overtly about race.
That was like the first question. Did you buy this house? Like, yes, we did buy it, you know.
Bridesburg has one of the highest home ownership rates in the city. And local leaders say this is exactly what's allowed the neighborhood to remain stable. Joe Slabinski is a third generation business owner in Bridesburg.
We keep a close eye on what's going on to try to keep owner occupancy at, you know, single family. We try to avoid as much as we can duplexes.
But Yali and her mother know both sides of this story. For most of their lives, they were renters, using public assistance. Brenda Santiago, Yali's mother, said she always took pride in their family home.
I mean, when I was a renter, I maintained my house. I made sure my sidewalk was clean. When it snowed, I shoveled.
When they made the jump to become homeowners in Bridesburg, it was a big deal. And sometimes, Yali doesn't feel the neighborhood can see how much pride her family has in being here.
I think that is still my current, like, love affair of this area. So it's like, I feel safe, and I also really love my house.
Bridesburg's old guard is well aware of the neighborhood's perception as exclusionary. Just like back in the 90s, they chalk it up to a few bad apples. Yvonne Stevens, the head of the Neighborhood Civic Association, says she hopes people like Yali and Brenda will come to her if they feel harassed or unwelcomed.
And if you're the person that are a longtime resident of my neighborhood and somebody new came in and you're doing this to them, shame on you, because you're making yourself and me who has lived here bad. And you're really throwing it out there that Bridesburg is something that we're not.
Yali and Brenda are still wary, but for the most part, they say their neighbors have come around to them.
I think we got over our initial, like, hazing phase.
Yali compares Bridesburg to a Japanese manga series called Dr. Stone, which tells the story of two kingdoms fighting to rebuild a distant planet. A war breaks out between the two factions, but ultimately, they come to see the light.
I think right now it's a divide of color, not realizing that we just want our kids to be safe. We want to feel safe when we walk around the street. We want to be able to help each other. We want to make this area grow in the best possible way. And so hopefully by the time I'm some of the age of the people who live here now, I'd hope we would have gotten it together.
From Bridesburg, I'm Max Marin.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A group of educators has met for more than 2 years to practice what can be uncomfortable conversations in schools, particularly when it comes to race. 90.5 WESA Sarah Schneider visited a classroom to see what those discussions look like in practice.
Fifth graders at McKeesport Propelled Charter School spent the last few weeks examining the work of local photographer Teenie Harris, who documented the lives of Black Pittsburghers in the 20th century.
Says beautiful African-American historic pictures from the Crawford.
Crawford Grill. So remember we read that this morning? So remember we talked about they had their own dance club?
The Crawford Grill in the Hill District, where famous jazz musicians played, was one of the most documented locations in Harris's collection. The photojournalist's work captured what everyday life was like for Black people in the city, from social gatherings to high school graduations. Teacher Tamisha Cohen notes that images of joy and celebration often contradict the stories told during Black History Month.
We talk about slavery. We talk about Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. But we forget that just living our lives, we contribute to history.
The students brought in their own pictures of their families and friends and were asked to find similarities between the historic and modern photos. Most of the students in the class are Black, including Lena Jackson, who reads the reflections of her classmates.
We love to take family pictures. We both take baby photos. There are Black and white people together in some pictures.
The students said that the collections show the shared human experience. That's exactly what Cohen wanted them to take away from the lesson. People from different races may have very different lived experiences, but ultimately they have the same motivations.
I want them to see that we are literally the same people. Our skin is just different.
Cohen has regularly attended a professional development series called Empowered Educators at the Carnegie Museum of Art. The museum's curator of education, Hattie Lehman, started the series with a volunteer team of education advocates. Each session draws a theme from one of the art exhibits. A few dozen educators, from administrators to social workers, view the art and then sit in a circle to workshop a lesson that they could use in the classroom. Lehman says art helps teachers think of themselves as curators of their own content.
By the critical thinking prompts and the discussion prompts that we utilize in Empowered Educators, we hope that translates to their classroom as well and gives them that empowerment of vocabulary and a greater understanding and empathy for the students that they encounter each and every day.
In February, the educators visited the museum's new Teenie Harris exhibit and were asked to research an image to deepen their own understanding of Black life in Pittsburgh in the 20th century. The session inspired Cohen to bring the images into her classroom. She says she's still uncomfortable talking about race with her students, but it's clear they respect her and were encouraged by the lesson.
They see me more than they see their parents, right? And if I'm only focused on one aspect, then they're missing out on the world, because some of them might encounter, you know, different group of people, different race, different social standings.
A few years ago, the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Urban Education surveyed hundreds of teachers and found that many felt unprepared to address modern instances of racial violence. A majority of educators nationally are white women. One of the Empowered Educators facilitators, Jawanza Rand, is a doctoral student with the center.
It became very clear that there was a big issue around teachers and educators' capacity and ability to talk about race and racialized violence and racism in schools with their students.
Rand says participants are faced with uncomfortable topics, but they are asked to challenge ideas and not people, to assume good intentions, and to keep stories confidential.
We recognize that the work that we're doing can't be done unless we all start on the same page, at least in terms of community energy and openness and willingness to grow and learn together.
The monthly series is typically well attended. Facilitators say, though, they're measuring success by the feedback they've gotten from educators who say the sessions have challenged their own thinking. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, we'll talk with Thomas Agnew of the community arts organization Boom Concepts. He's encouraging young Pittsburghers to imagine their future and the city's future through art. You can find us online anytime at wesa.fm/confluence. This and every episode of the program is available via podcast. Download, rate, and review us wherever you tune in. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.